Hello and welcome back, or welcome if you're a newbie to Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michaelides. This is part of the Pantheon Group of Podcasts, an amazing site full of music-based podcasts. So go check out The Ball. If you haven't got anything to do, you have now. Today's guest is Mark Moreau. Mark ran, first of all, Blue Mountain Music, which soon became Island Music, the publishing company, and then went on at the age of 29 to run Island Records and did a great job. Signed some amazing acts, but who am I to tell you when he's here? Mark Moreau is coming up after this.
My name is Mark Moreau, and I've been tasked with trying to sum up a 45-year career in 15 minutes, which is going to be really tough. So I started at Island Records in 1983, I believe, and I started working for Blue Mountain Music, which was Chris Blackwell's personal publishing company that looked after the rights to U2 and Bob Marley and all the reggae catalogue and Free and some great things that he'd signed, in particular things that Chris had produced. And I had my first number one single, which was Pump Up the Volume in 1985, I believe, which I also signed to Island Records in America, and which gave them their first number one on the dance charts in America. And it kind of put me on the map, and Chris really sort of took me under his wing. I was only a youngster. I think I must have been 25 years old at that time. And he allowed me to sort of get on with being entrepreneurial and encouraged entrepreneurialism. So I started Island Visual Arts maybe 2 years later, which was film and television production and distribution. Then I got promoted into running Island Music. And then eventually, when I was 29 years old, I was promoted into running Island Records. And my run at Island Music was fantastic. I'd signed De La Soul. I'd signed Massive Attack, Shakespeare's Sister, a whole number of things that had big success. And then I got the job running Island Records in 1990. But the record company was in a bit of trouble at the time. My promotion was built into the acquisition of Island by Polygram. So Chris made a career decision on my and everybody else's behalf, which was to sell the company. And of course, I'd started working for an independent. And now I woke up one morning and I was the managing director of a troubled record company. We lost Robert Palmer, Steve Winwood and Grace Jones after delivering their biggest hits. So Addicted to Love from Robert Palmer, Higher Love for Steve Winwood and Slave to the Rhythm for Grace Jones. And it kind of only left us with two proper acts, Island acts, as far as I was concerned at that moment, which was U2, of course, and Tom Waits. And they were really the two sort of backbone artists. We had a fantastic catalogue, obviously. We had the U2 catalogue, we had the Bob Marley catalogue, and we had some great things in there. But we were in a bit of trouble, and I had to go into a process of really kind of re-engineering and rebuilding the company. So, you know, a lot of staff changes, a lot of artist changes, and we decided to concentrate on kind of polishing up the assets that we had. And we included in those assets the fantastic founder, Chris Blackwell, who is still with the company. And amongst the assets was the incredible Island logo and its catalogue. But we had to sort of retool and start again as far as artists were concerned. And I suppose NWA was the first of the releases that I had to deal with, where I ended up in court under the Obscene Publications Act for releasing Enfield for Zaggin and Straight Out of Compton. It was a very successful campaign. We won the case. The police had to return the albums. It was quite a cause célèbre. And I had to really hit the ground running because immediately I was delivered Achtung Baby by U2, which was, I'd already worked with U2 for many, many years as their music publisher, so I knew them well. But I inherited a change in kind of attitude, really, with U2. They'd had the huge success with Rattle and Hum previously, but it had been kind of critically difficultly received. I think they saw themselves reflected in the reviews that they were getting a little bit po-faced, maybe a little bit too serious. And then Achtung Baby came along where they threw irony in. And it was, of course, all mixed up with the fall of the Berlin Wall. They were recording in Hansa Studios in Berlin for that album with Brian Eno. And my first kind of job on a worldwide basis selling anything was selling Actung Baby to the world. And it was complicated because the first single was The Fly. I defy anyone to point out another U2 song that doesn't have a chorus, and The Fly had no chorus. So we had to come up with all sorts of shenanigans to get that to number one, which we did. And it sort of started a whole new era for me because I had a great new team. Everybody that I'd hired in was sort of similar age to me, 29, 30 years old. We'd all been number twos in other companies. My head of A&R, Nick Angel, had been number two in Mercury Records. And my head of marketing, Nick Rowe, had been number two marketing in Mercury as well. And we'd all got this lift, this promotion into a big job. And the one thing that I'd say that bound us all together is that we didn't know what couldn't be done. So therefore, we would try anything to try and make it work. And I'd had 8 years working with Chris Blackwell, and I understood the need to try and inculcate excellence into everything that we did at the company. So our A&R policy kicked off beautifully over the first few years. We signed PJ Harvey, we signed Tricky, we signed Nine Inch Nails right at the beginning too. We had the NWA success, we had U2's ongoing success. Actung Baby sold, crikey, probably 17 million albums. And then we signed acts like the Cranberries, which was signed to the American company. But we had responsibility for A&Ring it and making the records. And we just had this extraordinary period of success where everything really kicked off. Tricky, the Mercury Music Prize, I think we must have had 25% of all the nominations in the first 5 years. And I think over time, Ireland, the acts that I and my team signed to Ireland have won the Mercury Music Prize 5 times now. So that's PJ Harvey twice, Pulp, Elbow, Talvin Singh, all have won that prize. And I'm very proud of that. So it was a blessed time, really. Chris was still with us. We had the funding of Polygram. So even though it sounded like I was a bit negative when I said we were taken over by Polygram, it wasn't bad at all for the company because we were in trouble. We were needing to retool in terms of, acquiring great acts. And Polygram's resources allowed us to do that and in spades. And virtually, everything that we were touching was turning to gold. So it was a blessed time, a really fantastic time. But things change. There was a moment where I went to sleep worrying about Polly Harvey's new record on a Friday. And then on a Monday, I woke up and I was having to respond to what single should follow Barbie Girl for Aqua, because over the weekend, my company had acquired MCA, Universal, Motown, and everything else. And we had been acquired by Universal that had all of those labels, and they asked me to merge them together. So it was a period in the sort of around about 1986 of great turmoil, really, really difficult time, because I had this huge operation, Island Records, MCA Records, Universal Records, and the UK Motown office. And merging them all together gave me a sort of portfolio of about 300 members of staff and obviously a hugely expanded artist roster. The downside of it was that, of course, the accountants and lawyers have always got something to say. And so what they had to say was that I may have a pool of 300 staff, but in fact, I had a target of 70 of them. So I had to really go through a horrible process of untangling that and letting people go and trying to rationalize. And I found it personally very difficult. I absolutely loved Ireland and I still do. But one thing that Chris Blackwell did incredibly well was give me the sense that it was mine, that I owned Island Records. And I knew I didn't, but in my heart I did. So when I was asked then to smash it all up, break it to pieces and then remake it, that was a kind of second career decision that was made on my behalf. And I found that very difficult. And so I had built up this roster that included American acts like Nine Inch Nails and NWA and Ice Cube, because I felt that I needed to go out and find American acts and bring them in. But when suddenly I had the output of MCA and Universal, and I had amazing acts like Mary J. Blige added to the roster, or Blink 182, or even Aqua and Barbie Girl, suddenly having such a vast UK roster seemed to the accountants and to the lawyers like a bit of a luxury. So the one thing that I felt very good at, which was UK A&R, discovering and nurturing talent, was the one thing that began to get pulled away from me, because what they wanted was for me to sell more American product around the world. And I found that really tough. It was not necessarily the most pleasant experience, even though it was great having the pressure taken off and other artists coming through.
Excellent stuff. The trials and tribulations of running a label.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And then the accountants and lawyers come in and tell you you've got to get rid of half the people you want to do this stuff with you. Oh well. Mark Moreau on Moments That Rock. This is part one of Mark talking about his career. We'll be back after this.
Then a third acquisition happened, which was when Vivendi, which Chris Blackwell described as a French sewage company, acquired Universal. And I again was faced with, I survived, you know, each time I survived the cut, I was probably into my, I don't know, eighth or ninth year of running Island Records at that stage in the late 1990s. And I had to again make cuts and make changes and keep the accountants happy. And I began to feel really quite unhappy at that stage. And I was approached by my bosses, who could detect that I was a bit troubled. And they offered me to add to my portfolio Deutsche Grammophon, Decca Classics, Philips Classics, and to effectively take over half the UK roster of this vast Universal company. And I turned it down because I didn't feel that I had really brought the MCA Universal Island group together enough in order to be able to add another three labels to it. In turning it down, I managed to negotiate something into my contract, which was effectively the right to become the deputy chairman of Universal UK. So that nobody could be promoted above me. So no managing director of any of my rival companies could be promoted above me without them coming back to me first. I had effectively turned down that deputy chairmancy by turning down the Classics labels. But in doing so, in effect, they breached my contract because I had that right. And so that was the moment where I decided, right, that's it, I need to get out. And I quit. I pleaded constructive dismissal. I had a big argument, not too aggressive with Universal. They knew I'd been there for 18 years. They knew that I was still working really closely with U2. I was A&Ring U2 and had effectively had that A&R role for 10 years. And so I was allowed to go, but continue working with U2. So with U2, I still carried on with the A&R function for All That You Can't Leave Behind. But I also built U2.com for them, which was their huge website. And I did that because I've always been a huge technology fan. And I had spotted in 1995, when the graphical interface of the internet came about, I spotted the opportunity and I used my own credit card to buy U2.com URL, U2.co.uk. I bought islandrecords.com, islandrecords.co.uk, and I gave them the certificates. And I do remember Paul McGuinness saying, what's this? You know, you normally give me a Fortnum & Mason's hamper for Christmas, and now you've given me a piece of paper that says www./U2.com. What the hell's that? And I said, believe me, at some point, it's going to be a very, very valuable asset. And their thank you was to give me the budget to be able to go out and build that, which I did in 2000. So I quit Island Records in 2000, built U2.com, and then started my own management business. Because one of the things that really struck me over the time that I was working at Island was how few well-scaled and well-experienced managers there were out there. And I had loved working with Principal Management and U2, and I'd signed my precious artist PJ Harvey to them, as well as obviously having U2.
Obviously, you came into the music industry at a young age, but you were groomed working with music people, and then you were kind of working under accountants and lawyers, weren't you? So how was that transition?
Well, I think you've got to remember that I started as a musician. I didn't go to university. I left school. I decided that I was going to fix the world with my weeping guitar, and I was going to change the world as a prog rocker, just as punk hit, effectively.
You learned more from a 3-minute record than you ever learned at school.
And it's absolutely true. And I also learned more from a 26-minute record, like, you know, Echoes for Pink Floyd, than I did from anything at school. But I used to tell everybody that I was a professional musician who did a bit of gardening for a living. But the reality was that I was a gardener who did a bit of music for a living. I had an amazing early break. I worked as a gardener for Tim Rice, of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice for fame. And in the pissing down rain one day, he called me into the kitchen because he was feeling sorry for me. And he asked why an articulate boy was digging his Jerusalem artichokes. And I said, well, actually, Tim, I'm a professional musician. And he said, oh, all right, play me your demo tapes. And I did play them the following week. And he put me in the studio as an arranger. So I went into the studio with a bunch of musicians, and I worked on some Tim Rice stuff. And I really felt that my career was going to start as a musician, in particular in the studio. I loved working in the studio. But in reality, gardening caught up with me. I became very ill with an illness that at first they thought was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Then they thought it was leukemia. But then they found out that it was, in fact, a gardening illness called toxoplasmosis that you get from cat shit in the garden and cuts. And it took me right out of the game. I couldn't even lift an instrument, let alone a spade. And so for a year, I was hospitalized, and then I was eventually diagnosed, and it changed my life. It was one of those cathartic moments where I realized that life wasn't a rehearsal. So I moved to London. I got a job working at R Price Records, selling records over the counter in their smallest store, which was in Hounslow, which we used to call the R Price Meager Store because it was the smallest that they had. And on my one day off every week, Wednesday, I volunteered to work at a small music publishing company for nothing. So I interned every Wednesday at a company called Eaton Music, which was founded by a trumpet player called Terry Oates. He made me bring my guitar to my interview. So I had to prove to him that I could play the guitar. I remember him interviewing a receptionist who brought her coronet, and she had to play a little trumpet solo to be able to get the job as receptionist. And you know, those were real. He was a proper music man. And I worked on a project with Island Records. I got headhunted and then started working for the quintessential proper music man, which was Chris Blackwell. And I think he really liked me from a very early point, because we had such things in common. You know, I was actually a sort of minor public school boy. He was a Harrow public school boy. His father was a military man from Jamaica. My father was a military man from Mauritius in the British Army. And I think he saw us as kind of soulmates, but with 20 years in between age-wise. And Chris really sort of took me under his wing, and he gave me the education. He gave me the confidence to make me sign things that I really felt convicted, had conviction for, rather than signing things that were going to make us money. He inculcated in me this absolute belief that if you get the music right, the money will follow. Never chase the money. And so working for Chris was just a blessing. He allowed me my head. There were some certain huge deals that came my way that Ireland was punching way above his weight. You know, things like Massive Attack, where Chris supported me in the decision to sign Massive Attack. He just gave me everything. He gave me my career, and I will always be eternally grateful to him.
Running the company, if somebody kind of comes in and buys it out, then all of a sudden you're working for people that you've got to almost impress from day one, because they're there to balance the numbers, aren't they? I don't really think that if you two had been with a CBS, or as it was at the time, or a Warner's or something, they'd be where they are today. They were into Ireland for like $250,000 in tour support and stuff like that. And at the time, there was one band they needed to drop, and they dropped Ultravox. And it proved to be a good move, because you two really hadn't sold enough records at the time to warrant staying there for a label that was in cash flow crisis.
Chris really, really made me believe this concept that you're signing the people. You're not just, the job is not to fall in love with the music, it's to fall in love with the people as well, and to share a common vision. And if you look at my signings, I tended to sign things where they came complete. So the signing of PJ Harvey, I was not just signing an 18-year-old girl from Bridport who stared at her shoes when she performed. I was signing somebody that had a complete vision for her own artistic future. You know, she knew what she wanted in terms of producers, in terms of design, album sleeves, photography. She knew what she wanted from videos. She was the complete package. And she is the epitome, really, of the type of thing that I felt that I ought to be signing. And again, you know, fell in love with her music, but fell in love with her and her vision as much as anything else. And it was a guiding light all the way through, you know, whether it was Tricky or whether it was Nine Inch Nails, you know, Trent Reznor, somebody with an absolutely crystal clear vision for who he wanted to be. And it was perfect.
Wonderful stuff. Splendidly articulated by Mark Moreau, our guest today on Moments That Rock. And that's just part one. Mark will be back with more stories of his time working through Island Records and what he's doing now. I really do feel for those people who have to lay staff off. I was one of those back in the day as well. Because you really want to work with the team, but you're driven by accountants and lawyers telling you to balance books at the same time. So we're off now. Moments That Rock is part of the Pantheon Group of podcasts. Subscribe, come back and listen to this again next week. Thank you for listening. Subscribe. And if you like what you've heard, I'd love a review. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.